I'm going to say one or two more clarifying things that I hope will help. And then there have been two or three questions that have been raised with me over the break where in each case I said, this is such a fabulously brilliant question. It just has to be raised in public so that all may benefit. So we'll pick up those as well in just a moment. But let me say something more about Deuteronomy. This ratcheting up idea is really quite important. That is to say, as you move through the canonical storyline, you do see how things get ratcheted up all the way to the consummation. And new covenant type language is already bound up with the old covenant, including Deuteronomy. But this is the big but. The distinction that is argued for in Hebrews chapter 8 is the distinction established by antithesis. When you read Jeremiah 31, it's not depicting covenantal obligations in general terms and then saying that God's going to write them on the heart and so on, so on, so on. It is saying it won't be like the old covenant. It will be a new covenant. This is the way it won't be. This is the way it will be. And the chief distinction that is made... there is a distinction about the writing on the heart, but the chief distinction is they will all know me from the least to the greatest, and no longer will a man tell his neighbor. In other words, it's the abolition of the mediating teacher that we saw yesterday. And so the reason why it seems to me Deuteronomy is not picked up by Hebrews 8, but Jeremiah 31 is picked up by Hebrews 8 is because Hebrews is trying to establish where principial obsolescence already begins. And principial obsolescence begins where there is an announcement that a new covenant is coming that will not be the old covenant. Do you see? As long as you've got the more generic kind of language of the end of Deuteronomy, there is, I'm happy to agree, a kind of generic anticipation that what finally is required is more than just law-keeping. It's got to be the work of God on the heart and so on. That's correct. There is a trajectory that is leading forward. That's correct. But it would be incorrect then to say that anyone in the Bible then draws an inference from Deuteronomy itself that this announces the principial obsolescence of the Old Covenant. That becomes clear once you have the not this but that language that becomes clear with Jeremiah 31. Does that help a little more? Yeah. Now then, there were two brilliant questions. One was by, where's the lady? There you are. Could you all hear the question? Pretty much. The question you're raising needs to be answered at several different levels, it seems to me. The first is, if I happen to have seen that program in the West Wing myself. I think I saw a grand total of three of them, or four of them, after 8 years of watching. Of presentations, I saw maybe three or four programs, but because God has a sense of humor, I did see that one. And I thought at the time, boy, oh boy, oh boy, what you are really saying is that the rabbis have improved the law of God. In other words, God was meaner, and the rabbis are a little softer and gentler than God. Now, it is true to say that not only in the rabbinic period, but historically, even in the Old Testament, there was a great deal of the law of God that was often observed in the breach. So that some of the sanctions imposed by the Mosaic Code were not very often observed. That's true to say. Does that mean it's a higher moral code? Now let me come at it more broadly yet. I think what is often lurking in the background of many people in the West, including many Christians, is something like this. This is a caricature, but I need to make it clear. In the Old Testament, God is severe. He's super strong on judgment. But when you come to Jesus and the New Covenant, thank God, it's gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look upon a little child. And so, in the Old Testament, you've got this severe God, but thank God we got by that. Now we've come to gentle Jesus, and this is the fuller revelation. And then the question is, in terms of our discussion here, how does Jesus sanction this? I mean, how do you authorize this as you move from there to here, where you're taking away something of the severity of judgment? I would say that way of looking at how the testaments are put together is deeply and fundamentally mistaken. I think that the reason why people mistake it is because the most severe judgments in the New Testament are eternal judgments. And people don't really believe in hell. So, listen to these texts. Still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia. That's Revelation 14. In other words, people are being thrown into the winepress of God's wrath, and the angels are trampling them down such that their blood comes out the bottom and rises to the height of a horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. Now tell me that the God of the New Testament is a softer God. So the person in the New Testament who introduces the most colorful metaphors for the wrath of God is, in fact, Jesus. No, the reason why you have differentiation in the actual punishment laws is because the locus of the people of God in the New Testament is not a nation. The locus of the people of God is an international community called the church. Where in the church, the most severe punishment that can be imposed is excommunication. But the severity of excommunication is not social shunning. What it means is that a person is damned unless they repent. So far from saying that when you move from the Old Testament to the New Testament, you move from a more severe God to a less severe God, I think it's truer to say, as you move from the Old Testament to the New Testament, the pictures of God's love become progressively clear, and the pictures of God's wrath become progressively clear. As you move from the Old Testament to the New Testament, you see the depiction of God's love becoming clearer and clearer, and finally climaxing in Jesus and the cross. As you move from the Old Testament to the New Testament, you see the pictures of God's wrath becoming clearer and clearer, climaxing in the cross, and apart from the cross, in hell itself. So the end of the trajectory of punishment for murder in the Old Testament is not, oh, it doesn't matter now, we don't have to have capital punishment. The end of the trajectory is hell itself. And the only possible escape is King Jesus and the cross. So there is a differentiation in the economic mediation of physical punishment, precisely because the locus of the people of God is no longer a nation, but an international community, the church. The church does not have the right to impose such punishments. But the punishment that it does impose as the final sanction, excommunication, looked at from an eternal perspective, is far more severe. It's just that we don't really believe in hell all that much, so it doesn't strike us that way. Does that make sense? Might not be very pleasant, but at least it's consistent, I think, with how the scripture is put together. One of the hardest things to do in our age, and one of the things that needs most urgently to be done, is how to preach about sin and judgment in a way that is convincing in a secular society. To think through how to preach about sin and judgment and the wrath of God in our culture is one of the hardest things we have to learn to do. But if you can't do it, then you can't finally preach a convincing gospel-faithful view of the cross. You can't get agreement on the solution if you don't get agreement on what the problem is. Now there was another question. Yes. So the question is, in the antitheses of Matthew 5, does Jesus establish a hermeneutic by which we might be able to go and do likewise, come across some moral precept in the Old Testament and do something similar? The expression hermeneutic in this case bothers me just a wee bit, because Jesus actually handles these antitheses in two different ways, depending on which one is at issue. So that on the adultery one and the murder one, for example, there is no formal abrogation of the old one. It is saying that it looks forward to something more than mere formal chastity or formal restraint from murder to issues of the heart. And if they all did that and nothing more than that, then you could say there is a kind of way of looking at things that is consistent. But a couple of them actually introduce formal abrogation. Now, it's formal, but it's still interesting. You have heard that it was said, take your oaths in God's name, but I say to you, don't swear at all. Well, in point of fact, Deuteronomy makes it very clear that we are to swear in Yahweh's name. The reason why Deuteronomy 6 makes that point is because you always swear by what is highest. So that it's a way of saying don't be an idolater and swear by the surrounding gods. Make sure that you take your oaths in Yahweh's name. The trouble is that by the time of first century Judaism, this had become a cause for a great deal of rather specious exceptionalism, so that if you swear toward the temple, you're bound by it. If you swear by the temple, you're not bound by it. If you swear by the altar, you're not bound by it. If you swear by the sacrifice on the altar, then you are bound by it, and so on, so on, so on. And Jesus here, and in Matthew 23, works this out a little further and says, good grief, you know, if you're swearing by the temple or by the altar or by the sacrifice on the altar, it's still God's altar, it's still God's world, you're still ultimately swearing by him, and thus you're really introducing a specious excuse for telling lies. It's like the little kid who says, I promise, cross my heart, hope to die, and then when the person's turned away says, but my fingers were crossed so it didn't count. and thus it becomes just a way of telling lies. Do you see? And at that point Jesus says, abolish the whole thing, just tell the truth, let your yes be yes and your no be no. So it is after truth-telling, but there is, superficially at least, a kind of formal abrogation of what was not only sanctioned in the Old Testament, but was actually mandated. Still, it's worth remembering that in the rest of the New Testament, Paul can swear by Yahweh himself, by God himself. And he doesn't think that he's breaking something that Jesus said, because sometimes the reason why we swear is the reason why God swears in Hebrews. Not because otherwise he might be telling a lie, but to give an extra reason for people to believe he's telling the truth. So by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie. That is, number one, he tells the truth in any case, his promise is worth something. And number two, he swears by himself because there's no one greater to swear by. So there might be a place then for swearing in God's name in order to help people who otherwise think you're going to lie to believe that you're telling the truth. But in terms of what you yourself do, then you should be telling the truth in any case. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. And so the kind of arguments that you get, for example, in Jehovah's Witnesses circles about refusing to swear in court, for example, where they've taken Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount as a new law that they have to live by, fails to recognize that Paul, even after Jesus, can still swear by God and read Romans 9. And it fails to see what Jesus is finally after. Well, that's a bit different, nevertheless, than mere intensification or merely going to the heart. I mean, it's involving more complicated issues. And then there's another one of the antitheses that turns in part on a false listening to the law. You have heard that it was said, "Love your neighbor, but hate your enemy." Well, there's no antithesis that's quite like that in the Old Testament, although you can see where it's coming from. Do not I hate those who hate you? I hate them with a perfect hatred. So you can see where this is coming from. It has a certain kind of biblical sanction, but this is really quite a serious misunderstanding of how even the Old Covenant is put together. So that's a far more complicated thing that Jesus is doing in that one than merely intensifying something as he does in the adultery case, for example. So I'm not sure that there is a simple hermeneutic that's going on that you can say, yeah, that's it. And now I've got a formula. Plug it into this one, turn the crank, and out comes the right answer. Does that make sense? But when you do work through them, you can start still see the kinds of things Jesus is after: integrity, truthfulness, consistency, not using law as a way of forming excuses and so on. All right, this one is important enough that if you've got more questions, this is where to ask them before we plunge on. Yes. So it seems like, yes, but almost of ranking, as it were. Is that what you're saying? Yes. Yes, let me repeat it. I doubt if everybody heard, and then you tell me if I've got it correctly. In verse 19, it is cast in terms of who's least or who's greater in the kingdom. Whereas verse 20 is cast on whether you get in the kingdom or not. Is that your question? So what is going on between these two? Yeah. And that's a good question. The stronger of the two expressions, obviously, is in verse 20, that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you just won't get in at all. You will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. It's very, very strong language. Verse 19 is, along that least and greatest, understood in two ways. One way is to understand it as ranking. But there is another interpretation, and it may well be right, that it's saying something like, as far as the kingdom is concerned, you're the least, thus you don't get in. Or as far as the kingdom is concerned, you're the greatest, so you do get in. So, in other words, the language may not actually be explicitly related to ranking within. It may be. It may not be. It's not quite certain. The language is slightly ambiguous. And I'm not sure myself. But in terms of the point that verse 20 makes, you mustn't use verse 19 to take away from the point that verse 20 makes. Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. When I've expounded the Sermon on the Mount, I have sometimes called the Beatitudes the norms of the kingdom. Now, the reason for that has got to be textually driven. It's textually driven by the fact that the first and the last beatitude, verses 3 and 10 respectively, have the same blessing. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who are persecuted, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And when you have an inclusio like that, then it's a way of saying that everything in between is lumped under that kind of umbrella. It's bound up with that inclusion. So that although there are different formal blessings, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God, and so on. Yet these are all kingdom of heaven blessings. So I think what you're really getting is the norms of the kingdom, still cast in terms of what it looks like to live that way in this broken world. But these norms of the kingdom ultimately, finally, make sense only because of where the kingdom finally ends up. That is, in righteousness, in integrity, the peace of God, the humble who will get there, and so on. But it's still because it's cast in terms of those who are mourning, those who are weeping, and those who are hungry. It's clearly still looking first and foremost at this world. But nevertheless, you're getting a clash now of the norms of the kingdom lived out in this life. This is what it looks like. And it is meant to shake up people who are complacent about what kingdom living looks like. It's akin to what people mean today when they say something like cross-centered living, or what's the title of CJ's book? Living a cross-centered life. It's that kind of thing worked out now in terms of Beatitudes. Does that make sense? So, in other words, I think that that's an antithesis with the norms of the culture. They must have been very shocking when first articulated. And then verses 12 to 16 then show how such norms worked out in our lives have a bearing on the broader culture. Salt and light. And that's why the salt and light passage inevitably gets introduced into all discussions where you talk about the relationship between the church and culture. So I tried to do some of that in my book, Christ and Culture Revisited. And then that means that by the time you get to 17 and following, then Jesus then unpacks what he means by the kingdom as related to antecedent revelation. Because for any Jew, that's the crucial issue. How does what is being taught relate to what is already being taught, to the scripture that's already the given? Does that flow make sense? Where I'm standing here, I'm getting a bit of an echo. I didn't hear everything that you said. Say it again. But don't forget that the prologue in John is a prologue to the whole book. The Beatitudes in Matthew 5 are a prologue, if you want the word, not to the whole book, but to the Sermon on the Mount. And the reason you know that is because there is a literary inclusio marking the beginning and the end of the Sermon on the Mount. So before you begin the Beatitudes, in verse 3, you read, chapter 5, verse 1, "Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them." Then you come to the end, chapter 7, verse 28, "When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law." There are five large blocks of teaching material in Matthew, and each one of them is circumscribed by this sort of literary inclusio. So granted that that literary inclusio is there, then the Beatitudes have to be seen as an introduction of some sort to the Sermon on the Mount, but not necessarily to the whole book, although obviously there are going to be some thematic links. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yes. Yes. Yeah, I know that some people have had some very, very creative Old Testament connections with salt, but some of them have struck me as slightly bizarre, as if salt is a telminus technicus, you know, a technical term that must always have exactly the same meaning. You've got to ask what salt, it seems to me, in this sort of usage, was primarily used for in that culture. And it was not for salting your crisps or, you know, it was primarily a preservative. So I suspect that that's what's going on here, especially when it's coupled with the light theme. You know, the world is dark, and it's the light that's needed to bring some ability to see, to bear. The world is corrupt, and without refrigeration or freezers or frigidaires or whatever it is you have, or even ice boxes, what you have is salt. That's how you salted your fish, you salted your meat, that's how you preserve it, you see? So that you stop the corruption, the decay, you at least slow it down precisely because of what you are doing in the culture. It seems to me that that's far more likely an interpretation than any of the others, because it pairs nicely with the light. And it's the obvious use of salt in that culture. It wasn't being used for putting down on ice paths or for, you know, table salt. They didn't use salt in any of those sorts of ways. Yes, that's a very good question. It's often put. It's often put. Did you hear it back there? Is there a sense in which all Old Testament law is affirmed by Jesus unless abrogated, or alternatively, all Old Testament law is abrogated by Jesus unless explicitly affirmed? And I would say, with all due respect, a plague on both your houses. And in other words, I don't think that either of those formulas will work. But it'll be easier to answer that one, I think, when we come to 1 Corinthians 9 in a few moments. Okay? So let me have another run at that one. Now, if you belong to the theonomy camp, Greg Bantz and friends, then what you say is all laws are explicitly maintained unless they're explicitly affirmed. And law itself, law as lex, becomes the crucial controlling category. But to my mind, what that loses is text after text after text shows that there is something in the Old Covenant that's fulfilled in the New. Lex is not the controlling structure. Even what we saw in Galatians 3 rules that sort of thing out. The whole point of Galatians 3 is to show that the really controlling structure from Christian's point of view is the promise made with Abraham. And why do we need the law? Well, it was added for this reason or that reason. But the point is that the law is treated in some ways as not the controlling structure that first century Jews often wanted it to be. It's relegated to the second tier, as it were. And it's a second tier along the line of redemptive historical understanding rather than making it the controlling category. So, to my mind, the problem is that putting it in either of those categories is forcing you to conclusions about the way the Bible is put together that don't square with the way the Bible is, in fact, put together. But I think that'll be a little clearer when we get to 1 Corinthians 9. One more passage very briefly from the Gospels before we turn to the Epistles. I'm choosing this one not because it's hugely important from a hermeneutical point of view, but just because it's one that is often taken to be extraordinarily difficult and we should perhaps look at it. I puzzled over it for a long time, and then I read somewhere, I don't even remember where, a solution that strikes me as so obvious that I'm ashamed I didn't see it myself. First, John chapter 12, verse 37 and following. John chapter 12, verses 37 and following. Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, "Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" For this reason they could not believe, because, as Isaiah says elsewhere, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes, nor understand with their hearts, nor turn, and I would heal them. Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke about him. Now, this second quotation, verse 40, is clearly a quotation from Isaiah 6, which we already looked at yesterday in another connection. We saw it in connection with Matthew 13, if you recall, in the parables, the hardening of the heart and so forth. That's the passage, Isaiah 6, in which Isaiah testifies, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and so on. But now, this text is saying that the reason why Isaiah said this is because he saw Jesus' glory. Now, there are many passages in the New Testament where things ascribed to God are ascribed equally to Jesus because Jesus is God. But this one is so explicitly, restrictively, exclusively Jesus that it really does seem a wee bit over the top. How do you justify it? There have been many, many solutions that have been advanced over the years, and I've toyed with two or three of them. Let me tell you the one I think is most plausible. I may be completely mistaken, but I think it's the one that's most plausible. I think that verses 39 and 40 are, in some sense, all overstated, an excursus. In other words, the flow of the argument runs 37, 38 to 41. So, even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe him, 37, 38. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, Lord, who has believed our message and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Where's that from? It's not Isaiah 6. Where's it from? Isaiah 53. It's part of the fourth servant song. Now skip verses 39 and 40. Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke about him. So it becomes a way of affirming then that Jesus understood Isaiah 53 to be referring to the Lord Jesus, which is a common New Testament point of confessionalism. In other words, that means that, if this interpretation is correct, John understands Isaiah 53 to be verbal prediction, pointing to Jesus, not some sort of typological condition, typological foretelling through Israel as the ultimate servant and Jesus as the ultimate servant or something like that. Do you see? And certainly there are lots of New Testament texts that see Isaiah 53 as pointing to Jesus. So the reason why 39 and 40 are added is to confirm that this theme of lostness and being unwilling to hear is already present in Isaiah. Who has believed our report? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For this reason, they could not believe, because as Isaiah says elsewhere, you see, they belong to this horrible group where the truth itself is precisely what blinds and deafens and hardens and condemns. Which is exactly, of course, the way Jesus has picked it up in Matthew 13, which we looked at yesterday. In other words, there is a hardening theme that is worked out in Isaiah, namely Isaiah 6, before you get to Isaiah 53. But the actual line of argument runs, I think, from the end of 38 to 41, with 39 and 40 most plausibly merely being, excursus is too strong a word, a further exposition of the nature of hardness along the lines that we looked at yesterday. Does that make sense? I don't think it's a knockdown, drag-em-out argument, but I think it makes sense. And if you say, Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory, what's the glory theme doing there? Doesn't glory rather draw you to Isaiah 6 than to Isaiah 53? Well, it could, although if you remember, one of the things we looked at yesterday was the way the glory theme develops in John's Gospel. John's Gospel, the glory theme that starts in the prologue that we looked at yesterday, we have seen his glory, the glory of the unique one, full of grace and truth. That glory theme begins with the miracles. So in the Cana of Galilee, the MC and others saw the miracle, but the apostles saw the glory. But by the time you get to chapter 12, this chapter, the glory of Christ is seen in his being lifted up on the cross. That's in the immediately preceding verses. Thus, it seems to me that John is connecting the ultimate glory of God precisely with the suffering servant, that is, with the cross itself, which is tied to Isaiah 53. Does anybody want to raise any questions about that one? Yes. Yeah, the question is, why couldn't the even assuming that it's referring to Isaiah 53, why couldn't the referent be on a typological axis rather than explicitly to Jesus sort of axis, granted that there are instances that we've looked at a couple of days ago now in which there seems to be a reference to something in David which is not really to David but to the Davidic typology or the like. And you're right. It's hard to rule out completely. But I think that there are two or three things against it. Number one, the Davidic typology is so well established on so many axes, again and again and again and again. We just looked at two or three of them, but not only through Psalm 2, but through Psalm 45 and so on, where clearly the referent in the Old Testament, as in Psalm 45, cannot be Jesus, because he's the one who gets married and has children who replace their fathers and so on and so on. And the referent in 2 Samuel 7 cannot be Jesus, because that particular king, Solomon, actually does commit sins and so on and so on and so on. And yet there is a Davidic typology that runs right through the Old Testament. So you're driven to that sort of conclusion. Whereas the suffering servant theme, it's a theme, it's not exactly a typology that runs through book after book after book and so on. It surfaces in some Davidic psalms, like Psalm 69. And clearly there are some uses of suffering servant in Isaiah that clearly are referring to Israel. So I'm not denying that that's already there. But it's not a sort of multi-book, cross-the-Old-Testament sort of typology that is really built upon in a huge way. More importantly, when you look at how Isaiah 53 is picked up in the New Testament again and again and again and again, the connection to Jesus is often very, very tight. I think that the New Testament writers really did understand Isaiah 53 to refer to Jesus pretty explicitly. It's hard to understand. In the case of, let's say, 2 Samuel 7, it has to refer to Solomon. It can't refer to Jesus. In Isaiah 53, you certainly can't say it can't refer to Jesus. It's got to refer to I don't know, Israel or something. In fact, it's pretty hard to make Isaiah 53 refer just to Israel. Some of the early servant songs, you can understand them to refer to Israel pretty nicely. But it's pretty hard to understand Isaiah 53 to refer to Israel. So that you're not driven to the conclusion that it's using the text to point to the typological axis. The more natural reading, with substitutionary sacrifice and so on, it seems to me is precisely the way that that the New Testament writers regularly take Isaiah 53. Okay? Now then, we're going to leave the Gospels behind, and we're going to turn, first of all, to 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians 9. But while you hold your finger in at 1 Corinthians 9, especially beginning at verse 19, while you hold your finger there, let me draw your attention back, first of all, to 1 Corinthians 7. Now, in the section on change of status, we read, verse 7:18, was a man already circumcised when he was called? That is, when he was converted. He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Verse 19. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. How would a first century conservative Jew read that verse? Wouldn't he say, Paul, that's nuts. Circumcision is the command of God. Do you see? And this is one of only a number of texts in Paul where Paul says things like that. This doesn't matter and that doesn't matter. What's really important is obeying God. But now, explicitly, keeping God's commands. The only thing you can conclude from that, unless you are arguing that Paul is a twit, the only thing you conclude from it is that for Paul, keeping God's commands is not identical with keeping the Mosaic Law. Because the Mosaic Law does demand that you circumcise. Do you see? So there are a number of hints like that already in Paul before you get to a passage like 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Now, it may be that we're going to have to spend a bit more time on the argument of all of chapter 9 so you can follow the flow. But let's begin by just jumping into the text itself and seeing how far we can get. Although I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law. But I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak I became weak, to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in its blessing. So is Paul under the law or not? You see, the very least that you must conclude from this paragraph, it seems to be the very least, is that Paul presents himself not as a Christian Jew who is prepared to flex to win Gentiles. Rather, he presents himself in what theologians across the centuries have called a tertium quid, a third place. In other words, he's not a Jew who has become a Christian who has to flex in order to win Gentiles. He sees himself as a Christian who has to flex when he goes after Jews in one direction and has to flex in another direction when he goes after Gentiles. So he says, I am not under law, which clearly means something like, I am not under the law covenant, but he's prepared to become like a Jew when he's going after Jews. He's flexing in their direction. And likewise, he's prepared to flex in a Gentile direction, though he does not see himself as utterly lawless. He says, I am not free from God's law. And then realize that that by itself is going to sound just like a massive contradiction with what he's just said. But he says, I'm under Christ's law. So he's under the restraint of God, under the command of God in some sense, as mediated by Christ. And he can flex toward the Gentile side, but that means that he is neither seeing himself as a Gentile who flexes to win Jews, nor as a Jew, a Jewish Christian, who flexes to win Gentiles, but he sees himself in the tertium quid. He sees himself as a Christian who has to flex one way or the other way to win people from the two sides. Is that clear in itself? Now, we need to say more about that, but I think we've arrived at the point in the morning where we're supposed to take a 3-minute pause or a 4-minute pause, but without abandoning the chamber, standing up, shaking ourselves in all directions, and so on, and then we'll run to 12:40 or whatever it is. Okay? Okay.